Welcome back to Hunkering Down with Peter Schorsch. It's been a long time since I last did this podcast. A lot has changed and a lot hasn't changed. I thought when I first did the podcast Hunkering Down that that was going to be a short-term thing. And I remember we talked about Tiger King and The Last Dance with Michael Jordan as things that people should watch on Netflix. And we were talking about Cocktails to Go. And then I thought when we got vaccinated in February, March, April, that we would be coming out of it. And this would be, as somebody said today, hot girl summer or hot vax girl summer. And really not all of that has come to bear. And we are, for a lot of us, still hunkering down. I read somebody today said that the risk is low of contracting coronavirus, but it is still high enough that you should be careful. And so that's what I am. I'm being careful. I'm hunkering down. And I miss people. And so I decided to launch the podcast again so that I could talk to people. So today I've got two women in Florida politics that I find very interesting. Michelle Rayner Goolsbee and Anna Eskamani. I was encouraged to talk to both of them because they were both impacted by the death of the actor Michael K. Williams. And I wanted to talk to them about that, but I thought it would be a good jumping off point to catch up with them in a very interesting pre-campaign period. We're not fully into the election cycle. There's still a lot of maneuvering. There's still redistricting. But you can see once you get past Labor Day, when you look at all the announcements that have happened over the last week, including Wilton Simpson for agriculture commissioner, et cetera, that people start thinking about the campaign trail again. So bringing back this podcast, I encourage you to listen to this one, to the pod that I do with my friend Jared Moskowitz. We now have Tramell Gomes hosting Sunrise. There may even be a chance that I can get Michelle to rejoin us for He Said, She Said. Podcasting is a big part of what we are doing going forward. I'm hoping our new colleague, our returning colleague, Christine Sexton, maybe even does a healthcare podcast. So first, a word from our sponsors, and then I'm going to talk with Michelle Rayner Goolsbee.
Following is a paid political advertisement paid for by Florida Education Champions. Online sports betting, it's legal and it's coming to Florida. With passage of our amendment next year, any tax revenues collected are required to supplement the Florida Educational Enhancement Trust Fund. Hundreds of millions of dollars in new revenue for students and teachers, with more choices and competition for Florida consumers. Be a champion today. Learn more and request your petition at FloridaEducationChampions.com.
Welcome back to Hunkering Down with Peter Schorsch. My next guest, she was first to respond to something, but I'm really excited to have her come in because of a connection that she and I have forged over the last couple of months. State Representative Michelle Rayner Goolsbee is joining us now. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. How are you? How's the family?
We're doing really well, and that's a good place to start. I know a lot of people on, I know a lot of people in Florida politics, but you have been disproportionately kind to our family over the last couple of months with everything that Michelle has been going through. And it just speaks like volumes to your character, how persistent and how consistent and how generous you were with your time and spirit. And I'm overwhelmed by it.
Well, Peter, I mean, and I'm such a water bag, but don't make me cry. But as you know, I lost my dad at the end of last year. And knowing what it is, that this is just a really rough time for a lot of people. And I just, at the end of the day, while we work in this process, we are humans first. And I think that that's what matters. And then, you know, my wife lost her mother at a very young age. So we just kind of felt really impacted by your story and Michelle and Ella Joyce. And my mom still asks and prays for Michelle and calls her by name. She is written down on her prayer list. And so it is, so there's no, you know, there's no thanks or anything needed. We're humans first. And that's just kind of the way that, you know, we just live our lives over here.
Well, again, it speaks volumes. We've been inundated with so many good spirits, like just, you know, the people that we expected to be there have been there, you know, our good friend, Stephanie Smith, our good friend, Alan Suskey, even people that are going through their own thing. They were there, but it was really some of the people like kind of out of left field. I had to tell Michelle as she was like coming out of the coma. I was just like, I don't think you realize like how many people are rooting for you. And I'm like, you're kind of like Ferris Bueller right now, where you've taken on this like community central role right now. And people are rooting for you. And then some people came back to me and were just like, listen, it's just been such a dark period that we needed something to get behind. And I still feel that now. And that's why, like, as she continues to hit some triumphant moments, like getting back on the Peloton and so forth, she cooked her first meal for us last night. She made roasted chicken.
I'm hopping up for the leftovers, Peter.
It was good. It was really, that's all I wanted was a Michelle, this very French roasted chicken. And so, but let me ask you a question going back to you about your dad in a way. Am I crazy or is there just a lot of sadness? Is it always been this way? Are we all hurting in a different way? Like what is going on right now?
You know, I feel like it's always been a lot of sadness, but I think because of the pandemic, we've been home for, you know, 18 plus months, maybe longer. That is very punctuated and that everything is really in our faces, right? We can't really run from it. We're not traveling like we used to. We're not, you know, going on vacations. We're not getting away. So I think everything is really punctuated. And then we're so just politically divided, politically polarized, you know, and that's kind of bleeding over into personal lives. And so I think that while we've always gone through stuff because it's life, I think that it's just really, really punctuated at this point in time. And it's hard and it's really just hard, you know, just stuff. My hope is that you would think that this would make us better humans. And for some folks it has been, and for other folks, they've just kind of doubled down on the divisiveness. And I think whatever, you know, life throws at you, you should try to be the best person and best human that you can be. And that's kind of how I've, you know, been approaching this whole situation that we've been in, and especially just a lot of the personal loss that I've had over the last 9 to 10 months.
I'll introduce this podcast when you're not here, but you're the first guest back on a podcast. I launched back, I think it was March, April, May of last year. It was called Hunkering Down with Peter Schorsch. And it was basically, we were all hunkering down, and I interviewed as many people as I could very quickly. Just a lot of them, just some of my friends. And you know, this is right when the Tiger King thing was getting big. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, what are you watching? And everybody said, you know, I'm watching Tiger King. And, you know, then we got to kind of a period where we weren't hunkering down, and I didn't really want to even do the podcast anymore. I thought it served its purpose. We've got this kind of suite of podcasts. We've got Sunrise Now with Tramell Gomes, and I've got mine with Jared. But as I was thinking over the long Labor Day weekend, I really like my podcast. I like myself just talking with people. And I also like, I do feel like we're hunkering down again. And I also feel like there's like a lot of it, there isn't like last year when we were going through all this, it was like, oh, cool, they're going to do a Zoom with the cast of Hamilton and that'll get us through tonight. Or they're going to do a concert with, you know, so-and-so, or they're going to, we still have the novelty of like launching movies on streaming services. We were talking about it. It was kind of fun when, you know, they did the cocktails to go and everybody had this like communal aspect, like, hey, we're going to get a drink and you can get in our car. And that's not illegal right now. And you're just
right.
And so I don't know what possessed me to do it again, but I just want to talk to people again. Like I miss being like at the conventions and the conferences. And I know some people are out there doing them and I'm not begrudging them. I don't feel 100% safe. And so I don't want to, you know, I go by the metaphor, if one of the M&Ms in a bowl full of 1,000 M&Ms can kill you, would you eat any of the M&Ms? And the answer for me is I'm not going to eat any M&Ms.
And that's a great metaphor.
that's what it is. It's a big, and so I just kind of, I'm avoiding stuff. I'm hunkering back down, but I just want to talk to people though. I want to know what you're up to, what other people are up to.
Yeah.
So I don't know. So the last iteration, again, it was Tiger King and Last Dance. Those are the two things. And it was kind of funny, like everybody, when I would interview them, we were talking about it. And what kind of got me going this time was the tragic death last night of Michael K. Williams, the star of several HBO shows, most notably The Wire, but just an acclaimed, I don't want to say he was a character actor, but he would be in that, like, he was nominated 5 times for Best Supporting Actor. So he just, anytime, he wasn't necessarily the star of so many shows. I know there's a lot of people that may not know who he is, but you instantly recognize him now as an actor. And he was really coming into his own with Lovecraft Country. He was becoming not just an actor, but almost a star. He died, and it is tragic because it's a drug overdose, mm-hmm. of which there were something like 90,000 in this country last year. Wow. We still have, I mean, that is raging, you know, just as bad as it ever has. So I put out a call. I'm like, hey, you know, are you a fan of The Wire and are you in Florida politics? Because I've always said there are two types of people, those who have watched The Wire and those who haven't. And so what did the passing last night of this very charismatic, iconoclastic actor, what did it mean to you?
You know, it's actually brought back when I first saw The Wire. I was actually in a relationship, not with my wife, with someone else. And we were talking about moving to the next level in our relationship. And I said, and they had asked me, have you ever seen The Wire? And I was like, no, I've never seen The Wire. And they're like, yo, we can't go any further until you watch The Wire. And I'm like, it's just a TV show. And I literally sat there. It was, you know, when like HBO used to do those, like they used to do those marathons of The Wire, and it happened like the next weekend, like HBO started doing the marathons of The Wire. So I started at episode 1 and I was immediately hooked. And what I loved Omar. I loved Michael K. Williams's character, Omar, because he was this incredibly complex character, you know, a Black gay man assassin. but there was a humanity about him that he was able to shine through. And then as I kind of started following, you know, Michael K. Williams's career, you know, the stuff that he's done on Broadway, he was a dancer, all of these things, it was just, it brought back the complexity and the beauty of just life and of Black people and of this amazing actor. And then to how he passed away, you know, when we're thinking about mental health in this time, as we talked about just a little earlier, and how we're coping. And then also when we're thinking about, you know, drug overdoses, what does that look like? It was profoundly sad because he's 54. He full of life. And it just was also sad. I was thinking about this last night, you know, as I was going to sleep, like making sure we give people their roses, their flowers before it's too late. And just, it just was just really, really sad. And because I felt like also it's kind of with Chadwick Boseman, it's just like he had just so much more to give, right? He had so much more to offer the world. And I know that may feel like a little selfish for us, but it just felt like he just had so much, his talent just shone so brightly. And so it was just really just devastating. I mean, and I saw your tweet and I was like, I felt the same way. Like, no, like, what are you talking? Like, this is not happening. Like 2021, like we're going to do this year. So it was sad. And then to see like the tributes pour in from actors that I love and folks who worked with him on The Wire, I have a few friends that actually knew him. It just was really just, it was sad, Peter. Like, it was just sad. Like, that's all I could say. Well, it was devastating, heartbreaking.
Let's break that down a little bit. Like, I think number one, and I think you go with the Michael K. Williams being I think there was a tweet last night. I just want to see black actors grow old. I don't remember who said it, and I'm paraphrasing. But it does go into the Chadwick Boseman situation, and it goes into a lot of black actors who you know, black actors, black musicians over the last 20 years who did, you know, I was thinking about it. I'm like, you know, the reason why Morgan Freeman gets as much work as he does is because he's the only one still of that generation that is working. That is, you know, like I think I saw Bill Duke. Who for some people, Bill Duke was the bald black actor in Predator. He was also in Commando. I think he was in Running Man. He was in almost every Arnold Schwarzenegger 80s movie. And he was just in the Steven Soderbergh film that came out. Bill Duke is such an intense actor, but there isn't a lot of 75-year-old black actors that are recognizable to contemporary audiences. And, you know, part of it was, again, that tweet, you know, just from that person. I would love to have seen Chadwick Boseman at 55, 60, you know, and see where he was with his craft at that point. You know, that struck me. And I guess when I'm talking to you, it's hard not to talk about, you know, the Omar Little character. Here was a gay character, but the sexuality was not central at all. And I think that was, I can't think about how unique and almost startling that was, that you had this black gay assassin, as you say, and it was just okay. And I'm not saying it was a groundbreaking role, but in a way, I think it sort of was. There aren't a lot of black gay assassin bad guy characters on TV or in movies.
Right. And I think that even when you think about, you know, black masculinity, especially like in, you know, it was set in Baltimore, right? It was set in the hood in Baltimore. And so when you think of black, you know, masculinity, these hyper, you know, sexualized, and here was this man that was a man's man. Like, I mean, he would, like, Omar's coming, right? Like, you know what I mean? And then he had this, who he loved and who he was attracted to. And, you know, it, especially when The Wire was initially on television, you didn't see a lot of black male gay characters on primetime in that way. And the way that he was able to portray this intensely, intensely complicated character in a way that brought humanity to him and brought humanity to Omar Little. Like I said earlier, like it was kind of, sometimes you're like, I'm low key rooting for Omar. Like, you're like, you shouldn't root for Omar because he's horrible. Like, he's a horrible human. Like, he's killing people. He's dropping bodies, you know? And, you know, boarding them up in houses and all of those kinds of things. But it was just, it was incredible to see how he was able to weave those themes in that character. And I think that even speaks to the beauty of the show, The Wire, as well. You had, you know, a Black gay woman who was Snoop, who was essentially an assassin as well. And, you know, you had the issues of, like, you know, how the younger generation, Michael and Dookie, like all of them, like how it just was interwoven. And so I think it just spoke to the beauty of the show and the beauty of the actors that were able to portray it and portray these characters. And I think it was just so, but there was something special about Michael K. Williams that just transcended even The Wire and even the screen. And just there was and even, like, I think about, like, the scar that was on his face. It was the beautiful imperfection of him. And he was a beautiful human. Friends who've told me who knew him, beautiful spirit. And he had this scar that, you know, sometimes just on face value kind of look at and be like, okay. But there was a beauty that radiated from him, and he was able to portray that on the screen. And I think that's also sad. It felt like a beautiful spirit has left us.
I'm going to throw something out to you, and I don't know which way you're going to go with this one, but I will say, I remember when I got back to St. Petersburg in 08. No, this is end of, yeah. Late 08, and I was involved with some downtown stuff. They were trying to rejuvenate the parks down there. This was back, homelessness was a big issue. Bill Foster, that was his big issue as mayor. I remember talking to a couple of the cops. It was a street unit that worked extensively on keeping that part of the town clean. I said to them, you know, The Wire, as much as it is about Baltimore, it could be about St. Pete in this sense, that you had a very, you have about a medium-sized city, and you had a police force at the time, much different than it is now, but there was basically the alliance of really powerful Black police officers, Goliath Davis, Al Williams, am I thinking? Cedric Daniels. Yep. You know, that these were the guys, and that was the power structure in St. Pete. It would be a Northeast politician, Bill Foster, Rick Baker. They would kind of partner with the African American leaders, and they would beat, you know, basically the Kathleen Fords or the Kirk Kurtzingers or kind of the outsider candidates. And it reminded me, in a way, of Baltimore, where you couldn't win mayor, you couldn't win without, you know, without reaching out. A white guy couldn't win mayor without having a very strong presence in the Black community. And it made those politicians, I think, react differently. Certainly Rick Baker, I think, did. But I also, there was a lot of, I don't want to say corruption, because that's not what it was, but there were just a lot of disconnect between the police force. I mean, people who live in St. Petersburg now forget that, like, one of the last major race riots in an American city took place. This is, you know, pre-Ferguson, the BLM movement. But before that was 95 in St. Petersburg. And I think
Lewis, yeah.
That was one of the last, there wasn't any from like 95, 96. I think Cincinnati had a bad riot. There wasn't as large of a disturbance up until the last couple of years, until you got to Missouri and so forth. Am I crazy? You know, any thoughts on my crazy theory that there are lessons, at least, that you can pull from The Wire into St. Petersburg?
100%. I mean, Peter, I even say, and I've said to folks, we're juking the stats, right? Like, I've said to folks, like, y'all are juking the stats. I mean, I think that The Wire was just this macrocosm of what happens on a micro level. And I think, to your point, when you think about, you know, and I don't know if it's, to your point, I don't think that we have that kind of same police force now. When we think of the Goliath Davises and you know, his team of people and how really, you know, they were very instrumental in even controlling what Black electeds, you know, got elected. And, you know, you think about The Wire and you think about how, you know, not only was it a police drama, but it was also a political drama that was also adjacent as well. Who sat on city council? Who didn't sit on city council? Who was the police commissioner? Who was a major?
I don't think you get elected 15 years ago. To be quite honest, I don't think you get elected from your state house seat 15 or 20 years ago.
100%, I would agree. If I was running, you know, 10 to 15 years ago in St. Petersburg, someone like me, a Black queer woman with a wife, right?
Yeah, I don't know that I don't know if that gets past the gatekeepers but for a variety of reasons. I think you're right. And that speaks to the progress that's been made.
They knew my uncles. Rudy Bradley, who's a former state rep, is my uncle. You know, Harry K. Singleton.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Harry K.
Holy cow. Wow, I did not know that. He was at Northeast when I was at Northeast. So, yeah. Wow, I did not know that.
And then Harry K. Singletary, who was Lonnie Childs's secretary for the Department of Corrections, the first Black man, that's my mother's brother. And they know, you know, they know my uncles. Ruth Emay Manuel, who is Ken Welch's cousin, it was my godmother. But even with all of those ties, kind of how I show up in the world and my identities, to your point, I don't know if that would have been able to translate because it was just different. And I do think back in the time period that you're talking about, you know, that was very much, I think you could draw a lot of parallels from The Wire to St. Petersburg.
All right, let's talk. I'm always amazed at how long these things go in a good way. You are running in arguably the most battlegroundy district in Florida. Like, I always talk to people about this district. I'm like, this is the most battlegroundy district in the most battlegroundy state in the country. Yeah. And, you know, if you go back to Alex Sink versus David Jolly, it was at that point the most expensive congressional special election. It has gone back and forth, you know, that this is the Bill Young seat for some people, you know, that it was the invention of modern Republicanism, that there were not Republicans in cities until Bill Young held the seat. Obviously, it's now Charlie Crist's seat and he's running for governor.
Right.
But it's the idea, it has to be redrawn to some degree. I think that it needs to pick up about, it has to pick up about 30,000 voters. As anybody who doesn't know Pinellas County, your district basically begins at the water. So there's no, you can't add dolphins. So you got to go north.
Yeah.
And if you go north in Pinellas, you're adding Republicans.
Right.
And you're
kind of Arrakis. Yeah.
And there's just really, there's no other way to slice it. Now, I know there's some crazy people who think that you can, you know, go back to where it jumps across the bridge, but I think that that's been struck down. And that is whereas the state legislative map would stop at the Supreme Court, the congressional map could go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
They would weigh in and they would knock down that congressional map. It's not going to be that may not happen in the state Senate or a seat, but it would definitely happen in the congressional. So the congressional is going to be a Pinellas seat. It's got to go north. It's got to add about 30,000 people. Most of those people are going to be Republican. Therefore, it's going to make the seat even more purpley or, you know, more red. But it still remains a battleground seat.
Right.
And even before that, you have to get through really one of the most interesting competitive primaries in Florida politics. You've got State Representative Ben Diamond. You've got Eric Lynn, who is a former Barack Obama administration official, and then you've got yourself. If I'm leaving somebody out in the primary, I don't mean to.
I don't think you are. No, I think that's it for the Dems, and I don't foresee anybody. You may know because Peter, you get receipts. You may know someone else who may jump in. I don't know anyone else
until qualifying closes. I would not. I mean,
yeah,
I just I just don't, nothing surprises him anymore.
Correct.
I could see this crazy scenario. I don't even think it's crazy. I could see the scenario where you, as who you are, state representative, good track record, you know, Ben and Eric split the Northeast St. Pete vote. You pick up South St. Pete. You're more progressive than those two. I mean, it's just, you're clearly got the progressive track. You could very much, I mean, anybody that's betting against you on Predicted is a fool, I will say, at this point. How do you see the race shaping up?
Yeah, so, you know, Ben and I are good friends. We've broken bread, and we're going to remain friends after this. I don't know Eric well enough to, you know, I didn't serve with him. You know, I will tell you this, in the words, and I actually said this when I was considering running it. I said, if I shoot my shot, I best to not miss. And that was my nod to Omar Little. I actually literally said this to my team. If I shoot my shot, I best to not miss. And so for me, I think that one, obviously we can talk about the high level stuff. Yes, it's where I believe I can do the most good and all of those things. But when you're looking at the numbers, and I have some of the best folks on my team, I know I'm working with John Ducote, who I know you know very well, and Matt Burgess, who used to work with Betty Castor. And we have, you know, a lot of people who know Florida for real. And how this district is going to break down, I definitely feel that there is a way that I can come out of the primary. Now, is it going to be a fight? It's going to be a dog fight, 100%. This is not, I'm coasting, you know, I'm not coasting into a general at all. But, and I know that there's going to be a fight with even fundraising. You know, love Ben. Ben is a great fundraiser, right? There's, you know, there's the establishment, and then kind of to your point, the progressive. So it is, I think, really the way I see this this race shaking down, it's just really going to be a fight to the finish, and it's really going to be really to making the case. But I do think that there's a path for someone like myself to get out of the primary, and whoever is on the Republican side who gets out of their primary, it looks like right now it may be Anna Paulina Luna, you know, then she and I will do what we need to do if I get out this primary. But yeah, and even to your point, you know, I was born and raised in Pinellas County, was born and raised in North County. I know y'all St. Pete folks feel like you have to get a passport to come up there. Was born and raised in North County. So, you know, strong, my father is from there. My mother's family's from there. And then also being from St. Pete. So there, I always say to people, there's only so much you can do with this Pinellas seat. There's only so much. So we're going to see. It's going to be very interesting. Redistricting committees are going to be real interesting to watch. I chose not to even ask to be on one because I don't want to be subpoenaed when this gets litigated, because you know it will. And so but it's going to be really interesting to watch as well, especially now being in the process as a member watching it, to kind of just even from the outside, not being on the outside of it.
All right, so I'm going to wrap up this interview like I did the last iteration of Hunkering Down. Tell me something. You may not even be hunkering down, or you can be, or you're hunkering down less, but we're still, I think for the most part, people are still, they're hunkering down more than they were 18 months ago. Tell the audience who will be listening what's something that you are watching or reading or doing that, you know, you recommend that they take up. Again, 18 months ago, everybody was on Tiger King. I kept telling everybody, you don't have to recommend that anymore. Everybody's watching that. Trust me. So what are you watching or reading right now that's worthwhile and sharing?
Okay. So my wife and I are watching Married at First Sight, Houston. If you have not watched it, go to the season before and watch Atlanta. It was a ish show. It was horrible. But it was like really good horrible. So we're watching that, and we've been watching a lot of Netflix. So we've watched High on the Hog, which is really good. I love cooking.
Very good. I just got done reading that book.
Very good. We've watched Sex Life was really good. I don't know if y'all have seen that. And then we are going to be starting Clickbait as well. So Reality People, Married at First Sight, all the other ones on Netflix. And I actually we're hunkering down a little bit more because my wife is immunocompromised. She has some heart valve issues. So we stay in a little bit more. So I do a lot of like flowers decorating and I do a lot of cooking. I have perfected my collard greens. Me and J.R. Williamson are having a Sunday cook-off in Tallahassee. So Peter will make sure to send you a plate. But yes, yeah, so I perfected my collard greens so much to the point my mom was like, you can make them for the holidays.
That is awesome. I love good collard greens. I'm envious of Jair. I want some of his, I saw those pig shots that he was on. And I'm like, how have I not made those before? I mean, those look so terrible for you, but delicious. All right. Michelle Rayner Goolsbee, you can follow her on Twitter at Michelle, it's 1L, Michelle 4FL. And yes. What's your campaign website?
It is Michelle with 1L 4 and then Florida spelled out. So michelleforflorida.com.
All right. Thank you so much for being my first guest back as we're hunkering down. I wish you the best.
Thanks, Peter. Take care.
Joining us now on Hunkering Down with Peter Schorsch is a guest from, I believe, he said, she said, so glad to have her back, Representative Anna Eskamani. How are you?
Hey, Peter, it's good to see you. Thanks for having me back. I'm so grateful for all your incredible updates and insight, and it's so much fun to be with you on the podcast.
If there's anybody who lives and breathes Florida politics more than me, it has to be you with the just the activity you, you know, that you go through as a state representative. I mean, you make so much out of being in the Florida House.
Well, you know, I've always been someone that has a lot of grit and resilience. And I knew when I first ran for office that being in the Florida House would not be easy. Like I never ran on a false premise or delusions of grandeur. I knew that it would be a lot of work. And That is in my family. It's my blood to do the hard work. And of course, I am someone who runs towards the fire, not away from the fire. And I do my best to create as much calm in an environment of chaos. And the Florida House is, you know, a very important place for people like that. So it's a journey every single day. I have my lows and my ups, just like anyone else, right? And I just try to be as optimistic as possible, but really honored to be in this place every single day.
For this is a podcast, so people won't see it, but it's interesting. You have behind you the Rebel Alliance on your door. I have behind me Lego, the Lego Batwing. And so we're definitely showing our geeking out here.
I love it. That's awesome.
It's so crazy because there really is so much I could talk to you about. You are, you know, you're a global thinker. I mean, you follow foreign policy, obviously, with your heritage. You follow national politics and things that are going on from Texas. I'm sure you have a dozen people like working in the California recall election, probably activists that you've worked with throughout the country or something like that.
Right.
But the lesson about anything is, you know, if you talk about everything or if you put in everything, you've got nothing. So I'm going to focus today. I told you I really wanted to talk about, you know, just the horrific ruling out of Texas. This is something that you worked on, abortion rights issues throughout your career. I think people know what's going on. I found it interesting today that Mexico decriminalized abortion. So you had this very odd contrast where Mexico has a more lenient abortion policy than the state of Texas at this point.
Right.
Why are you so scared of this bill and what's going on in Texas?
Well, it's the most extreme abortion ban in the country. I mean, plainly stated, right? And for those who don't know, I really entered advocacy as a reproductive rights champion. I mean, this has been an issue that's always been personal for me. I grew up in Orlando in an immigrant family, a working class family. We never talked about dating. We never talked about relationships, even intimate partner violence. Those conversations never came up in my household because it was just taboo. We didn't talk about it. And then when my mom passed away, I remember when she was really sick, she wanted to have these conversations with me, Peter, but I told her, and this is one of my biggest regrets in life, I told her we can talk about it later, because I felt that if I accepted her advice at that moment, that I was accepting that she wanted to be here later to give it to me. And so I resisted. I said, oh, we'll talk about it later. Don't worry. We have plenty of time to have those conversations. So when she passed away, my period hadn't even started yet. Like I was going through all those changes that a 13-year-old girl goes through without her mom. And so Planned Parenthood was there for me as a safe place to go to get my questions answered, to get a method of contraception that's right for me. And I started volunteering at Planned Parenthood after that as a health center escort, walking patients inside the health centers while protesters were outside. So when I say these issues are personal for me, it's not about a Democrat versus Republican debate. It's not even about a quote pro-choice versus pro-life debate. It's about people, like directly impacted people, and the consequences of bad policy. And so Texas in particular, obviously it's egregious because it's an abortion ban, but the other elements of it is this bounty system, which was a legal scheme that helped them avoid a temporary injunction by courts, because it's not the state enforcing it, it's everyone who enforces it. And they create this incentive of $10,000 to continue to perpetuate not only abortion stigma, but like eyes on you, right? If you're having a private conversation at a coffee shop or an Uber driver is taking you somewhere, they can now all be liable to you making a decision to end a pregnancy in the state of Texas. So I share all that because I remember in Florida what it was like in 2015 when the legislature passed a 24-hour mandatory delay law. I worked at Planned Parenthood at the time. And this was, again, one of those legal battles where it goes back and forth, right? You get a stay gets lifted, the stay comes back. When you are dealing with people's healthcare and people's lives, it's not a headline. It is real life repercussions. And I rushed to our Kissimmee Health Center that Wednesday morning on July 1st, of 2015, because we had scheduled patients that morning for abortion services from every part of the state. And they're in the parking lot crying. They're in the parking lot trying to figure out how they're going to come back tomorrow with their job, transportation issues. There were folks that were trying to pay me to get in. And I had to explain to them, no, this isn't about cost or, you know, trying to persuade or a person. It's about policy and politicians who think that they know better. So that's, you know, where all my anger comes from. And to be clear, it's more anger than fear for me, because candidly, Peter, you know, in life, we are prepared for moments that we don't even expect. And so I tell this to all my colleagues, whether they're in the movement spaces or in the legislature, it's like, we've been preparing for this moment. So don't panic, because we don't have time to panic. We have to stay focused and vigilant and center the issues on directly impacted people. And that's where my source of fight comes from.
I look at it, I think you're right. It is a personal issue. And I think that there are, I'm sure in Texas, there are thousands of women who believe that they are and will say that they are pro-life and have had to make the difficult decision to have an abortion. And want that, I think of all the things that poll, like even more so than like the so-called shy Trump voters, I think this is one of those things where there's a lot of moms out there who will say that they are pro-life. I believe I'm pro-life, but then I'm not faced with the situation. And then when you get faced with the situation, especially if it's a horrible situation like rape or incest, then you want that exception to the law. And
right.
I'm warning my Republican friends, like, I don't know if there are any issues anymore that can really sway an election. Like, I don't know that we're not polarized. And I think that we're too polarized for something that you can drop a bowling ball in a bathtub. But I feel like if the Florida legislature does go forward, and if you were to implement the heartbeat bill here in Florida, the so-called heartbeat bill. I think that that's where there will be women running for office that you never expected. I think that you will see moderate suburban, center right women, going the other way. I think you're seeing it already right now in California, where Newsom is, I think, on his way to a bigger win, because he's basically saying, I'm not going to allow California to get anywhere near where Texas is.
And so 100%, Peter. I mean, that's so well said. 1 in 4 American women have had an abortion in this country. Every single one of us loves someone who's had an abortion, even if you don't know it. And it transcends political lines. And so when you take away this fundamental right from people, they get pissed. And I think one of the points that you just made that I want to amplify quickly is moderates picking a side. Because I think for a very long time on multiple issues, including abortion issues, folks are happy in staying in the squishy middle. Like, they don't really want to have an opinion, or they don't really want to talk about it. And if it comes up, it comes up, but it's not something that really drives them per se. Like, they're just in this middle place. Now you've given people an ultimatum. Do you want to ban abortion, or do you understand that it's a private medical decision and everyone should have the opportunity to make that choice as a healthcare decision, right? With their family, with their God, with their doctor, not with the politician. So it does force a lot of these folks not only to wake up to the risk that this could be gone for me and my children, but also to decide, what side do you relate to more? And I do think that the winning side, whether you look at polling or even election results, has been this right to privacy piece. And Florida is no different. 2012, the ballot amendment 6 was placed on the ballot by the Florida legislature to try to weaken the right to privacy. And it failed. It failed overwhelmingly because Floridians care about privacy. So I think all of that, I want my Republican colleagues to remember as they're debating what policy agenda to set for this next session.
I really, I got to tell you also, I really don't want to, I think what's happened now with this coming out in September is this now becomes somehow the abortion session. And if the last session was really thrown off its cracks by the debate over the transgender athlete bill, which did not have far-reaching real-world implications, to be frank about it. I think it is a hugely symbolic act, and there are thousands of people that care about it. But I for one don't believe that it is widespread like what this bill would do. This could turn the entire session. It could just knock everything off the rails. That's not good for anybody.
You're speaking to culture wars, right? Versus like real life policy implications. I mean, at the end of the day, the past session was a lot of culture wars, and it was like boogeyman. It was like creating a fake problem, fixing the fake problem just for election talking points later. Like, that was very much the theme of, at least for my humble opinion in the back rows. The day it becomes law, it changes everything for anyone who has the ability to become pregnant. So I think for a lot of voters, they can isolate themselves from LGBTQ+ issues, which is, in my opinion, wrong, but folks can do that. Really hard to separate yourself if you have a uterus on this issue. And so 100%, I definitely agree with that assessment.
It's funny, when Michelle and I first got together, this is 2011, kind of my like entry into Florida politics at the national level was when they did the Incorporate My Uterus movement. And I went on Mad Out and started, Ben Pereira and I started a website where you could go on and incorporate your uterus, so to protect it. And we started that. And then Rachel Maddow like teased it out on her show, and it just like crashed all of our servers. And it was a fun night. I got to give Michelle credit. She was, I think, the one who came up, well, for almost all of my ideas. She usually comes up with them first. She came up with sunburn. I always forget. And she's like, no, you idiot. I came up with that. You were just sitting over there.
That's really cute. That's really cute. Also, it's quite full circle for me too, because Representative, now Tax Collector Scott Randolph, used to represent parts of my seat. And, you know, it was also him and his wife, Susanna, that was the brainchild behind that point that Scott made on the House floor. So, I mean, it's, and that's something else too, Peter. It's like, 10 years ago, these same fights were happening. You know what I mean? And it's like, can we solve real problems right now? Because it's like the wheels just keep turning. You're going backwards. Like, we have actual real life problems to solve. Why don't we focus on those instead?
What does this look like in 5 or 10 years? I guess that's part of like my deep fear. And I was really hoping that this was not going to be the case. I was thinking Biden gets elected, we get vaccinated, Trump kind of fades. There's enough economic stimulus that everybody's kind of happy. You know, and it just seems like I never wanted to think about Handmaid's Tale again. And I just feel like at any moment, like I read the stuff about just about where these people want to take this country. And they're, you know, whereas I don't hate the people that are pro-life, but they certainly hate the people that are pro-choice. And I worry a lot about the Gileadization of kind of like our politics right now. And I'm scared for raising, like, there's an incredible story in the New York Times, I think, or Wall Street Journal last night, talking about the gender gap in higher education, which I'm sure you were aware of, but it is now at its greatest point. It's basically 1.5 women to one man on college campus. And the more I thought about that, you know, that is an easy way, if that continues, to where you demonize higher education, learning, science, et cetera. If you live in a male-dominated society, which like Texas seems to be pushing itself to, then you really, and these men are not educated. They're purposely not going to college. It really does like kind of push your way towards this very weird society where there's a lot more men who are uneducated. And then just, I mean, because I feel like if you do get to college, it does open up your mind. I'm not saying you can't be conservative. I'm not saying you have to be liberal, but it certainly opens up your mind. I just got to believe that there weren't as many college graduates in the January 6th insurrection as there were not college graduates. I could be, you know, stereotyping there, but I worry about that. I worry as a father of a 9-year-old, and I know like that's a shitty excuse. Like I've learned not to use that as a reason to care about women's rights and issues. Well, just because it's your daughter doesn't make me care about it. But as somebody who is raising, I think about where will Ella's opportunities and challenges come from? And is she going to be raised in a state or a society that is just, like a Texas where her rights are strictly limited?
Right. No, it's a real fear. And again, it helps make the issue more personal for those that might not have a direct connection to it. Now you do, right? And with the people in your life that are impacted. And it makes me think of, I was talking to a colleague of mine around, there's more of a focus on winning elections than on policy right now. And that's dangerous. If you're just focused on winning for your own personal gain and your own sense of authority or power, then you're not focused on like the actual ramifications of policy. You know, good policy is a little wonky, a little nerdy. It's creative. It's all stakeholders together. It's all ideas together, including conservative ideas, right? I met someone earlier today, a group of veterans, and we were talking about issues with refugees and just thinking about veteran services and other policy debates. And, you know, they asked if I was like a left-leaning libertarian, which I thought was really funny because I'm like, those don't really go together, right? But I am someone that like cares a lot about trying to integrate values that are different than mine into a solution, because you can't find a solution unless you try to find those areas of similarity at the end of the day. But the current political spaces, it's not attuned for that. It's like, it's more about I'm right, you're wrong. And like that zero sum game is not, it's not my definition of America. I mean, the America that my parents came to make home is one that supported the tired and and the weary, and it's the one that, you know, supported my mom through all of her treatments. I mean, of course, we suffer with medical bills. And so those are the areas of the American dream that I'm committed to changing. But the kindness that folks exhibited towards my mom and the stories I hear today, you know, folks that touched her life or she touched theirs. I mean, like, that's the spirit of this country, of this state. And so when I look at a policy proposal and it's just like, all it is talking points. And it's not even substantive. It's not trying to solve a problem. You know, again, that feeds into this broken cycle. And the sad part is that with former President Trump making a home in Florida, I feel like we become the litmus test for conservatism based on his standards. And that is a race.
And
to
it's
the
a weird, it's a different, here. It's a different conservatism.
Oh my God, completely.
Then like I don't recognize it. And I have a lot of Republican friends, probably more so than I do Democratic friends, to be quite honest. And they don't recognize it. I will say, and I tweeted this, and this is as true as it's ever been. I mean, my media base is the Republican lobby corps. And I will tell you, I've had so many of them just say and express, you know, just complete. No, what they say is that Ron DeSantis is an a-hole, and that they don't understand that they were with him in before, and now they just don't understand what this is all about with the masks and the basically warping what they view of limited government. Now, a lot of these folks, this is, you know, there's a lot of Jeb Bush holdovers there. They don't like Trump. But I will tell you, like, if DeSantis were to lose tomorrow, there would not be a lot of tears out of Tallahassee, and he might not even care about that. But I think there is. I will also say this: like, I think DeSantis is in trouble. I think that in the same way that Buddhism teaches you not to eat angry meat, I feel like Ron DeSantis has created a lot of angry meat out there, and that his favorability has washed away. And I don't know that he necessarily gets him back. I'm not saying he doesn't get to 50.1%, but it is going to be a challenge no matter how much money he has at this point.
His strategy is, all I need is 50 plus one to love me, and I don't care about the 49 that don't. And it's like, that's
doesn't
never
care about
been,
them at all.
Right. And that's never been a path to success in even in his own election, right? He didn't campaign like this in his first election. So it doesn't even seem intuitive to what his history demonstrates. And I guess they're just
two questions about the governor's race while I've got you.
Oh, sure.
Do you regret not running? I mean, the last time we talked on the pod, you know, you were still speculating. There was a lot of speculation, a lot of enthusiasm for you. Do you regret not being a statewide candidate right now?
I don't. I you know, like I said, I have a few regrets in life, but this is not one of them. I feel like I don't run to make a point. I don't run because of ego. I don't run for a title or attention. You do the work. You got to do the work. And in politics, there's a lot of folks who are queen bees, not a lot of worker bees. And I do think it's really important to do the work. And when I look at the work that I want to get done, Peter, I realize that it's very, it can feel more transactional to do that work when you are the candidate. Like, I want to build infrastructure for my values, not for myself. And so I don't have to run statewide to do that. It was, you know, part of my thought process when I made the decision to stay in the Florida House. And also, there's, you know, it sounds a little funny, but when I was at UCF as an undergrad, if you can imagine it, I was a big nerd.
Go Knights.
Yeah, go Knights, Tarjan. And I got my first A minus my senior year at UCF. Like, I was a straight A kid and I got my first A minus. And this professor, I mean, I was like so upset because, you know, I was on this path of just like straight A's the entire college career. And he told me, you know, you are a really bright star, but bright stars can burn out really fast. And that always kind of stuck to me as very sage advice of like, people will want you to grow. People will be very supportive. There's also people that want you to crash and burn. And at the end of the day, you got to listen to your heart and decide like what makes sense for you and your personal ecology, and don't burn yourself out. And so I also kind of looked at just, you know, my own like mental health and well-being, the things that I want to get done in my not just my public service, but my personal life as well. And it's like, there's no reason to be that star that tries to, you know, be on this fast path. Like, we all have our own journeys. It's so important that we're intentional with listening to like both our head and our heart. And so that was a part of my formulation. And, you know, I feel really confident I made the right decision. But it's exhausting, even just being in the Florida house. And so
it's a lot. There's no such thing as a part-time lawmaker anymore.
No.
I just don't know anybody that handles it. And you certainly work overtime at it. Second question about the race, you know, it's the favorite game. I know you haven't endorsed, but give me a letter grade on and a quick explanation how you think Nikki Fried's doing, how you think Charlie Crist's doing.
So I don't know if I could do letter grade because I feel like it's more nuanced. They both have very interesting strengths. I mean, I think that Commissioner Fried for sure has the following. She has really fast responses to different issues, like, you know, shout out to Kevin Kate in creating the medium and the tools to do that. And a lot of folks, I think, especially women, are attracted to having a woman on the ticket. And at the same time, you know, Congressman Charlie Crist has, even as a Republican, had a track record of corporate accountability, which I appreciate. Like, I think that we do need to challenge industry to do the right thing and to look at the collective good. And he has a history of that. And I also, a lot of people just know him and trust him. And that carries, you know, a lot of credibility in a space like this. But we also know that Annette Tadeo might be running as well. And so there's lots of information on that too. So I think Democrats have some good options in front of them. But at the end of the day, we have to be focused on getting DeSantis out. And, you know, and I get frustrated when folks do start throwing at each other, especially so early, because it's like, we have time for that. Like, you know, like, let's focus on the long-term goal here, you know, but it's also expected in a primary space.
All right, I'm gonna wrap this up with you. Quick thoughts on the passing of Michael K. Williams. I asked some folks on Twitter today, if you loved The Wire and loved Flawpole, what were you thinking when you heard the news? Anything stand out to you?
Gone too soon, Peter. I mean, sometimes I think that there are people in this world that we just weren't ready for. Like, they were so insightful and brave and courageous that it's like we were it was luck to have them in our lives. And I mentioned this on Twitter, but I actually started watching The Wire in my freshman graduate program at UCF for my master's in public administration. It was required watching. and it was amazing because it really, you know, gives you, I can't think of a show that builds like so much frustration, but also empathy. And it really restores humanity, even in characters that have typically been stereotyped and criminalized, right? I think that empathy piece is so missing in politics. And he brought that to the screen in such diverse characters that I think are the personification of humanity. So, I mean, what a serious loss, for sure.
That is really, really well said. Well, I appreciate you coming on. You actually have more meetings the night as we are recording this, which is amazing, or you just got done. I'm sure you're going to probably organize something and volunteer and
I got two more Zooms
and everything like that.
Two more Zooms. Oh, look who's there. Hey.
Yep, Ella Joyce is here.
Hi, Ella.
All right, I want to thank Anna Escamani for joining us on the return edition of Hunkering Down. Our first guest as well, one of her colleagues in the House, Michelle Maynard-Goolsbee, will be back with some more Hunkering Down in the days to come.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, everyone.